Thank you for listening to this sermon recorded at the Lost River Church of Christ. For more information, check out our website at lostriverchurch.org or call us at 270-843-3163. We consider it an honor to share the good news of Jesus Christ with you completely free of charge. Have a great day and enjoy the sermon.
Well, it's good to see everybody out this evening. Appreciate everybody being here on a Sunday night. I know that's sometimes difficult. Small children, I know it's a routine for me. As Megan told me right before I got up here, she was like, you put Evie Kate's shoes on the wrong feet. That's the hurry that there is to get here on Sunday nights if you have small children. So appreciate seeing everybody out this evening. If you would, open up your Bibles to Mark chapter 1. Appreciate Tyler reading that for us. We'll go from there tonight. I've greatly enjoyed the series that Lawrence has preached this year around redeemed relationships. It plays directly into what I want to talk about this evening. On at least one occasion, and possibly more from this pulpit and from other places I've preached in Atlanta, I've talked about what I've learned about God because of the relationships in my life, and particularly because of my relationship to my children, what I've learned about God because I'm a father. I taught that lesson years ago when I first had Madeline. I've since taught it a couple times since then, and that lesson keeps changing. And that relationship and the other relationships that I have in my life reveal to us something about God. They reveal more of himself to us. And in listening to the sermons we've heard already this year, I've become more thoroughly convinced that God is the author of the incredible gift of relationship. He is relationship. He was relational in his beginning. He was the triune God. And that the relationships that we have in this life are intended to be a gift from him because he is the author of all relationship. All relationship comes from him. And so like most of my lessons, this evening's lesson comes from an event in my life and a passage from my own personal Bible reading that coincided very recently. And by way of introduction, what I want to do this evening is I want to talk about some of the concepts that Lawrence has already discussed, just as by way of introduction to kind of segue into what I want to talk about. Lawrence, I went back and listened to his original sermon, which was given back on January 3rd of this year, when he introduced the concept of redeemed relationships and exactly what that meant. And I want to bring those back to our remembrance this evening before we dive in to Mark chapter 1 this evening. So when we say that this year we are focusing on redeemed relationships, what do we mean by that? It's been 6 months since Lawrence covered exactly what that meant. So I went back and I'm like, well, that's like one of those things. Well, I think I know, but I went back and I listened to the sermon to just double check that what I thought I knew was meant by that was what was meant by that. And most of us here know, most of us who have been Christians have been coming here for quite some time, are familiar with the concept that the word redeemed, redemption has the idea of buying back, encapsulating it. And we most often think of it in context of our salvation, of our redemption of our souls, that God purchased those, buys them back. But it's more than a simple transaction. There's more than just a transaction, a buying of something that's going on there. The original word has the connotation of restoring something to its original condition. It implies that something was broken, that something was lost, or that something was less than what it would used to be. And we use that, this year we're using that term, this idea of restoration, bringing it back in terms of our relationships. And the gift of relationship with our God, with our family, with our church, with us in the outside world, that's been the subject of our focus this year. And we all know and all can affirm that that gift of relationship, in large part in this world, has been turned into a curse. And isn't that exactly what sin does? Sin takes something that was beautiful, something that was given by God in the very creation, and it turns it on its head and creates a curse out of it. And it was so funny to me listening to the sermon that was given on January 3rd, where we just talked very broadly about you know, redeemed relationships and how we live in a broken world, in a sinful world. And as I listened to that, and I just thought about all the events that have occurred in this country and other countries in the past 6 months since Lawrence gave that sermon. Think about all the horrible acts of racism, of hatred, of terrorism that have occurred in the past 6 months that are all endemic of the curse that relationship has become because of the sinful world that we live in. It's turned the gift of God on its head and twisted something that was beautiful and made it something terrible. And also, as Lawrence has presented this year, we as the people of God, it is our duty, it is our responsibility, and it is our privilege to seek the redemption of our relationships. And we are doing that because God has sought to redeem His relationship with us. God has pursued peace with us, His people, and our peace with Him allows us to redeem our relationships with everybody else. That's why we start with our redeemed relationship with God, because that is the fundamental. That's what we covered in the first quarter. If your relationship with God is not redeemed, if it is not restored, how can you ever hope to be truly at peace with anyone around you? And so that is the bedrock of it. But why does God care about redeeming relationships anyways? Why does God care to redeem a relationship with us, this broken and sinful people? Well, one of His primary characteristics is He is the God who heals. He talks about Himself, He names Himself that way in Exodus chapter 15, verse 26. There He says, "I am the God who heals you." We are the broken vessels that need healing. And the catalyst for this healing, for this restoration, is His love. And that is another characteristic that's obviously we talk about in context with God quite a bit. 1 John 4:8 says God is love. But God isn't just love in a theoretical sense. He's not just out there as a slab of love. That would never work. In order for there to be love, there has to be love and a beloved. And so we are God's beloved and He is the lover. And He loves us in that sense, and He heals us. And God cares about redeeming our relationships, not just with Him, but with each other, because He says that He's a healer, and He is our Father who loves us. And how does God's love manifest itself toward us? And Lawrence hinted on this quite a bit this morning. Again, John is very clear about this in all of his writings. You know, God doesn't just sit in heaven and wish thunderbolts of love into your heart. I've been guilty of that quite a bit. You know, you see somebody that's across the way and they just, you know, they look like they're downtrodden or whatever. And I just have that like I could just Zeus and I could just love right there. And it hits him right in the heart and he's like, "Oh, I'm loved." You know, the be warmed and filled. But I'm not even really saying be warmed and filled. I'm just feeling good feelings towards you because you look like you need love. And certainly, I guess if it was God's prerogative, He could sit up in heaven and He could say, "You look, you need some love today, and you need some love today, and you need some love today," and we could all feel better about ourselves. But that's not at all how God operates when He manifests His love. You know, what does He do? He comes down into this world and He gets right into the mess of it. You know, Lawrence gave that really great analogy. What if the God of heaven walked right out the temple, right through the veil, and started just getting right into the mess of people's lives. Just out there touching people, doing things, being with tax collectors and sinners. And that's exactly how He operates. That's how, you know, He's not just up there in heaven expressing good feelings. Instead, He gets involved in the ugliness of His creation, of His fallen creation. He reaches down into the world and gets involved in the messy nature of human lives. And He sends His Son to be a part of Himself into the world to get involved in sinful people's lives and to ultimately die for their lives. And with that as a backdrop, I want to again take a look at the passage that Tyler read for us in Mark chapter 1, 29 through 39. And there we see God, He's walked out of the temple, He's there physically, and He's getting involved right in the messy gut of human lives. He's there with his followers. Peter, Simon's wife, you know, is there. His mother's there. lay sick with a fever, and they told him about her at once, and he came and took her by the hand and lifted her up, and immediately the fever left her, and she served them. And at evening when the sun had set, they brought to him all who were sick and those who were demon-possessed, and the whole city was gathered together at the door. Then he healed many who were sick with various diseases and cast out many demons, and he did not allow the demons to speak because they knew it. And I dare say we've probably never seen anything like this in our entire lives. Can you imagine the entire city of Bowling Green knowing that there is a Savior for all the disease, all the problems, all the struggles that you've got, and he set up shop at Krispy Kreme on Campbell Lane? You couldn't even get to the door. There would be no telling what fanfare. Campbell Lane is bad enough. Can you imagine if everybody in the city, if we just emptied the hospitals, Greenview Medical Center, you know, all the retirement villages, everybody just wheel everyone you know and you love down to Krispy Kreme because Jesus is there at the door and he's laying hands on everybody, getting directly involved in the mess of people's lives. It would be amazing. It would be astounding. And that's exactly what we see Jesus doing here in these first few passages in Mark. And then we come down to Mark chapter 1, verse 40. And it says there, "Now a leper came to him, imploring him, kneeling down to him and saying to him, 'If you are willing, you can make me clean.'" And the word leper here, of course, can mean any number of skin diseases that may occur. But of course, obviously, it connotates the most famous that we know of, leprosy, which of course is just the rotting of human flesh. We've seen it, you know, it still is around today in some small bits and as Hansen's disease, but it was the rotting away of flesh, you know, fingers, facial features would just fall off as flesh just literally rotted off the bone. And the leper that you see here in Mark chapter 1, verse 40, is the picture, to me, is the picture of broken relationships. The leper is just the absolute picture of everything that's broken about his relationships. And they cannot be restored by human effort. Let me say what I mean by that. The leper, by law, is cut off from his family and from his community. He is unable to be with those that he loved, or even with those who he just sort of knew. All his acquaintances, all his family, anyone he grew up he was friends with, is totally cut off from those people. Those relationships are severed by the nature of his ailment that afflicts him. He couldn't even be a fully functioning Jew and wouldn't have even been welcomed into society. In fact, a leper would have been treated the same way as if you'd seen a skunk in the backyard. I make that analogy because I recently saw a skunk in my backyard. And the first thing I did was like, there's a skunk in the backyard. What do we do? And everyone freezes. So the first thing I did is I ran out and I threw a ball at the shed where he was crawling around. And that didn't scare him. So then I ran out. He snuck up on me and I dropped a trash can lid on him. He sprayed under the lid and I hopped back. But that's how they would have treated the lepers. They would have said, there's a skunk in the backyard. What do we do? You know, if a leper just snuck up behind your house and he was out there wandering and, you know, you saw him, you'd be like, get out. You'd be out there throwing balls at him because you don't want him out there with your kids. You'd be afraid you'd get it too. And that's how the leper would have been viewed. You would do anything to get a creature like that away from your family. And because he was cut off from the nation of the Jews, he was cut off from the temple and from other holy places, he was cut off from access to God, he was ceremonially unclean and unable to approach to worship or even ask the priest to help him. Instead, day after day and year after year, he sits waiting for a cure from a priest, from a prophet, but no one comes. And how many times, turn back to Exodus chapter 15, 26. Suppose that this leper that we see in Mark chapter 1, suppose that he's grown up a Jew, suppose that he's quite familiar with the Torah, suppose that he's been studying these things in a local synagogue, heard Exodus chapter 15 chanted many times. Suppose he knew this passage. If you diligently heed the voice of the Lord your God and do what is right in his sight, give ear to his commandments and keep all his statutes, I will put none of the diseases on you which I have brought on the Egyptians, for I am the Lord who heals you. Suppose that was a Jew who had heard that and at some point in his life developed this ailment of leprosy. You think those words echoed in his mind over and over and over again? How many times do you think he replayed that part of the scroll in his head as he waited time and time again for somebody to show up and heal him of this brutal illness that affected him? I would say that that was the only thing that he thought about time and time again throughout the vast majority of his life. He's looking for somebody who represents God, the God of healing, to step into his life and redeem his relationship with his body, with his family, with his community, and with his God. And one day, amongst just a great furor of people, he finds that after 400 years of no prophets, no revelation from God, no miracle workers on the scene, after 400 years, there's word that a prophet has arisen in Galilee, of all places. Just as was prophesied in Isaiah chapter 9. It had been told that it was coming. If you look back over at Isaiah chapter 9, verses 1 and 2, over there Isaiah says, skip down just a little bit to the middle of the verse, the land of Zebulun and the land of Naphtali, and afterward more heavily oppressed by the way of the sea beyond the Jordan and Galilee of the Gentiles, the people who walked in darkness have seen a great light. Those who dwelt in the land of the shadow of death, upon them a light has shined. And here is this light, after 400 years of no light, now suddenly there's a light, and it's in the land of Galilee of the Gentiles, and he's there. And so this leper from Mark chapter 1 travels probably some distance, likely in some degree of discomfort. It's probably, you travel when you have a small ailment, it's horrible. You travel with an ailment like leprosy, it's really bad. And as he walks, no doubt in some pain, he has to shout. By law, he has to shout, unclean, unclean, so that anybody who sees him as he comes forth can get out of the way. So he's an embarrassment to himself. He's an embarrassment to the community. He's walking in pain because he's heard that there's a prophet on the move in Galilee. And his fellow countrymen would likely stare and would judge him. Just like the passage we see about the blind man, where the disciples say, well, whose sin caused this man to be born blind? Was it his or was it his parents? The same thought that produced that in Jesus' disciples was an active thought in the Jewish community. This guy, whose flesh is rotting off his bones, must have done something really terrible to deserve what he's got right now. And so as he's shouting, unclean, unclean, mothers are hiding their children's faces and men are spitting in his general direction or walking away, or nobody is extending him any courtesy or any hand whatsoever because he deserves what he's got. And so it's possible that this leopard would have gone out of his way, even taking probably the harder roads to get out in front of Jesus, to avoid people, to meet him or intercept him in some open place in the road down the road. And when he gets to Jesus, he falls down on his knees and he implores him and he says, if you are willing, you can make me clean. And I want to come back at the very end and talk about the words of the leper. But I want to move on to verse 41 and talk about what Mark says about Jesus. Then Jesus, moved with compassion, stretched out his hand and touched him and said to him, I am willing. Be cleansed. It says that Jesus was moved with compassion. That phrase that we have there, moved with compassion, is one Greek word that I don't even pretend to pronounce. And it's used 12 times in the New Testament. And in every single occasion when it's used in the New Testament, all 12 times, it's either used of Jesus or Jesus is using it descriptive of himself or the Father in a parable like the Father and the prodigal son. And what it means at its core is that he was moved in his bowels, like literally his stomach churned within him. When he saw the display in front of him, when he saw the leper fall down in front of him, his bowels were churned. And that churning feeling in his stomach provoked severe emotion. And that was the passage that I was reading in my daily readings. I was rereading Mark. And it struck me because I thought, when was the last time I was moved with that kind of compassion? And there was a time here very recently, and this is not like one of those preacher stories. This is real. This is totally legitimate. You can tell because I'm going to try and keep the emotion down to about a 9 instead of a 10. So, there was an experience that I firmly believe that God allowed me to have that illuminated my understanding of this phrase even further. I was flying recently from Houston to Phoenix. I've been flying a lot more recently with my job. And I was flying on a business trip southwest Houston to Phoenix. I had the middle aisle seat near the very front. And across from me on the next aisle seat over was an older Asian gentleman. I don't think he spoke very much English at all. The middle seat on the other side of me was vacant. And in the far window seat was a little girl. And she couldn't have been more than 7 or 8. And when I got on at first, I saw her sitting over there and I thought, well, her mom's in the bathroom or her dad's in the bathroom. That must be who's in the middle seat. And then I quickly noticed that, you know, there was nobody coming. She was cute. You know, she was sitting there nicely to herself and I didn't really think anything of it. And it took us some time to taxi over to the runway. And I began to notice that the flight attendants kept coming over to check on her. And that's what they're required to do when children are flying by themselves. The flight attendants are, you know, you have to go and you have to make sure. And especially with a child that small, when it's 7 or 8, the flight attendants are told, you've got to go make sure and make this child feel safe and welcome. And so I began to take more notice of her as the Asian man that was between us. He immediately, once we got out to the runway, he put one of the sleep masks over his face so he wouldn't see me staring past him. And so he's now out of the picture and he's fallen asleep and put his head back. And so I look at the little girl and she stares down at the seat in front of her very hard and wouldn't very much interact with the flight attendants that were checking on her. She wouldn't hardly look up and even look at him. And she had a little plastic bag and a little purse, you know, as little girls are wont to do. She had a nice little purse with her. Her name was Ashley, and I heard the flight attendants talking to her frequently. That's how I know what her name was. They would always say, Ashley, do you want this? Do you want that? Her hair was blonde, and she wore the exact same glasses as Madeline wears. She's just those purple glasses, and she was sitting there just all to herself. And she had a scar on her chest right here that had proven she had had some kind of major surgery. It had gone way down. And so clearly she had had some kind of traumatic surgery at some point in her life. And as we taxied onto the runway, I looked over at her as I had begun to do. And in my mind, I was thinking, I need to be careful to not come off super creepy here as I'm staring at this little girl. So that's, you got to play that in my mind the whole time. And as I looked over as we were taxiing onto the runway, I noticed that tears began to run down her cheeks as she stared out the window and were at the seat in front of her. And she was never making eye contact with me, never making eye contact with any of the flight attendants. And she reached in her bag and she pulled out several My Little Ponies. Now, if you don't know what that is, I'm about to tell you. There's a little show. It's called My Little Ponies. It's awesome. My oldest girl likes it a lot. More than likely, Madeline's probably playing with My Little Ponies right now as I'm talking. And she has it, and she pulls them out, and she's playing with them, and she's staring down at her My Little Ponies, and tears are just streaming down her cheeks. And there's no... See, there it is. Yep. So there's no sound of sobbing. There's no anything, just silent fear and sadness on her part. She's just sad and clearly alone and afraid. And even then, as is right now, my bowels were moved just looking at her. My stomach literally was churning just seeing the scene. And I was angry in the first place. Who lets a 7-year-old on the plane without their parents? And that was my first thought. My first thought was just total anger. Like, I would never in a million, both of us would have to be in the hospital, and all the grandparents would have to be dead, and granddaddy would have to be in a conference because he's not dying. And so she's there by herself. And that was my original thought. I was angry. She was there all by herself. And she, you know, I remember sitting on the plane, and I actually started crying, looking at the little girl crying, because I thought, she's just like Madeline. She's wearing the glasses, she's playing with the ponies, and I loved her immediately. And she was alone, and she was frightened, and she was cut off from everyone she knew or everyone who loved her. And so right then and there, I decided that if we got off this plane and there was nobody at the gate to greet this little girl, I was adopting this little girl right out of the airport. And I hadn't really figured out all the technicalities of abducting a child right out of the airport on a business trip. Plus, my boss was back further on the plane. So I hadn't really decided how I was going to explain to her I'm taking this child with me. But I was convinced, like, we were getting off this plane, and I was calling Megan. I would be like, Megan, we're adopting a 7-year-old. Her name is Ashley, and she looks just like Madeline. Have a place ready when we get home. And I was certain that that's exactly how that was going to go on. But in the meantime, I realized that there's a very real reality going on right now that we have to deal with. There's a girl, and she's frightened, and she's alone, and she's crying, and something has to happen right now. And the thought of Ashley spending a 2-hour trip silently crying near me was not something that I was going to allow to happen. And as a flight attendant passed by me, one of the flight attendants, they were super busy, it was a packed flight, and I just motioned over to one of the flight attendants because, again, I'm 33, she's 7, and I don't know that, you know, me just approaching her is not probably a good thing. And so I say to one of the flight attendants, I say, hey, I'm like, give that little girl my phone. I pulled up Disney Junior and saw that something acceptable was on the free TV that they give out on the plane. And so I said, just give her my headphones and give her this phone. And the flight attendant's way too busy to be bothered. This thing is driving me crazy. The flight attendant is way too busy to be bothered. And so she looks over very cursorily at Ashley, and she just said, she's fine, and then walks on. I said, no, it's not good enough. I don't care if it's against FAA rules. I'm doing something other than what the flight attendant said. So I got up in the middle of takeoff, and I handed her my phone and my headphones, and I said, here, you know, take my phone. She stopped crying and looked at me and very timidly took my phone. She put the headphones in. She began to watch. And I watched her really hard for about the first 10 minutes, making sure that she didn't need my help or she hit the back button on my phone or anything else. I just wanted to make sure she was distracted enough to just watch that phone. And then after about 20 minutes, she looked over at me and she smiled. For the first time on that flight. And then she would proceed over the next hour, every 10 minutes or so, to look back over at me and just smile. That was all. She would watch the phone, and then she'd check back over at me, and she'd just smile at me. And she would also gesture to me and ask if I wanted my phone back. She would, do you want it back? And I would say, no, keep it. And at this point, I was inclined for her to just walk off the phone, and I'd never have that phone again. I'd just go get another phone. And she would smile and she would keep watching. And the last hour of the flight, she never even broke a glance from the phone. And she was now thoroughly distracted from her situation. And as we came to land, she handed me back my phone and she managed a timid thank you with a smile. And another flight attendant had seen what occurred and thanked me for sharing the phone. And as we pulled up to the gate, it's the policy of the flight attendants to walk, you know, the child up to the gate to where someone is there to pick them up. And I thought, okay. It's show. We're about to find out here if I'm about to have another child. So she says to the flight attendant, can he come with us? Fortunately, this was the flight attendant who had seen what had happened and not the other one, so she knew it wasn't something creepy going on. And so I said, sure. And so we walked up to the front, and then there, sure enough, her mother was there, and she ran and hugged her mother, and I just walked on out to the gates. knowing that she was fine. And I don't have a clue what happened to her or anything like that. I know that she's, you know, with her mom, whoever that is. But for that brief amount of time, my bowels were moved in a way that I will never forget. In the way, like, she smiled at me, and that's totally changed my perception of so many different things. So why do I tell that story? Well, because I learned something in that trip about God's relationship that He is seeking to redeem. And I looked across the aisle and I saw a young and helpless girl. And she was scared and she was alone and without a friend in the whole airplane. She looked like my daughter Madeline, who was quite literally made in my image. No one here could doubt that that girl is my daughter. No one here could doubt that Everett, my son, is my son because they look just like me. Now, Evie Kate looks just like her mom. But the other two are made just in my image. And through the experience of becoming a father, I am now able to understand not just intellectually what God means when He says in Genesis 1:26, He says, "Let us make them in our image." Now I understand emotionally and on a whole nother level what it means when God says, and He comes in this world and He looks at people who are made in His image, and I understand what He feels. I understand what that means, and that's a gift from God. That He looks down on us and He says, there's people there made just like me. Purposefully made just like me. And here is a leper falling down at the feet of Jesus, imploring to be made well. And when Jesus walks around Galilee and sees the hordes of people who are afraid, who are alone, who are broken, He feels, and so much more than what I felt on that plane. He feels it. And it's one thing for us to intellectually read Mark chapter 1 and see it. It's another thing to be in that situation. Think about the last time you were moved to tears because of something you saw. And that is the feeling times 10 that Christ had walking around Galilee, seeing the hordes of people made in His image, just struggling, scrapping, and clawing to get out of the existence of this world that's been so twisted by sin. And when the man God sees His creation subjected to suffering and they call out to Him, the very bowels of God are moved. Think about that. The bowels of God, His stomach churned when He saw it. That statement is so loaded with meaning to me. I have never, ever looked at a worm or an ant and thought, they're really struggling. Occasionally, I've seen that Sarah McLachlan commercial with the dogs and the cats and thought, I've got to change it right now. But I've never, ever thought there's some low, low being that I've seen struggling and felt it in my bowels. But the distance that between us and an ant is nothing compared to the distance between us and God. And yet He looks at this leper, as pitiful as he is, and his stomach churns. He's torn up about it. And what was it about this man that moved God, moved Jesus so particularly? He came and he said in complete dependency and in faith. It's hard to know exactly what the leper knew about Jesus, but he knew enough to know that this is a man who represents the God who says He heals us. And is that complete and total lack of anyone else to turn to and faith that moves the hearts and the hands of Jesus, and he stretches out his hand and he touches something that's thoroughly unclean and rotting flesh, and he says, I am willing, be cleansed. And here as we close, I'm going to say two things quickly tonight. To Christians out there tonight, I think we have to be willing to touch some lepers and be moved by their circumstances. And we often pray from this pulpit, and I know in our nighttime prayers and sometimes in our mealtime prayers, be with so-and-so who's sick, be with the financially struggling, be with those who are spiritually struggling. And that's a good exercise for us to undertake. But maybe what some of our prayers need to include is, God, maybe you should put a leper in my path today. Maybe somebody needs to just directly enter my path so that I can't miss them, that they're standing there and they're looking for me to help out. More so than just praying for, but that they're there, they're unavoidable, they're in my path, and they're there because God put them there, and He's asking for us to be the hands and body of Christ. Maybe that's one of the things that I myself need to ask for more often. Not just that I pray for the people who need my help, but that I pray that God puts someone who will need my help in my path today. And I would say to those of you who are not Christians, or those of you who know you're unclean, who know you're struggling, who know that you're lepers, look at the example of this leper here tonight. He didn't have to, there's no prerequisite here. The only things he had to know is that here's a man who can heal me completely. That he comes, he is the son of the God who heals us. And that if I can just get in his path and fall down at his feet and say, if you're willing, you can heal me. And what is the response from Christ? I am willing. Be cleansed. This is so powerful to me. There's nothing else to be done. All there is the looking and the faith and the knowledge that this man saves us from all our uncleanness. And if he can touch a leper and cause that flesh to be clean, it says there in verse 42, as soon as he had spoken, immediately the leprosy left him and was cleansed. If he can touch a man whose flesh is rotting from him, how much more can he touch your soul and cause it to immediately be clean? And if you're in that kind of condition tonight, if you're not a Christian and you need it, come forward, be baptized, and he will reach down his hand and he will touch you and you will immediately be clean. If you are a Christian tonight and you've soiled your garments, you've rejected Christ in your heart and in the actions of your lives, come again. He'll touch you again and make you clean. And we'll walk together with him. Come forward as we stand and as we sing.